This episode is brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768.
This episode is also brought to you by our good friends at Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, they've been a place to grow, connect, and serve. If you're looking for a church to participate with virtually during this COVID-19 lockdown, you can find their streaming services Sundays at 9 a.m. on their website or their Facebook page, and check in with their Facebook page throughout the week for encouragement, service times, and other good news. Visit them at canbyfoursquare.com or search Canby Foursquare on Facebook.
Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, I'm James Walton. Let's read the news. A Canby law firm is one of the two that filed suit against the governor of Oregon this week, claiming her COVID-related executive orders have violated business owners' constitutional rights and have done, quote, extraordinary harm to their businesses. The suit was filed in federal district court May 12th by attorneys James Bouchall of Murphy & Bouchall LLP in Portland and Tyler Smith of Tyler Smith & Associates PC in Canby. They request a preliminary injunction against Governor Kate Brown to prevent her from enforcing her executive orders until the case has run its course. The United States constitutions do not contain a pandemic or emergency clause, and defendants may not run roughshod over fundamental constitutional principles of liberty and justice with bare assertion that a health crisis requires such action. The attorneys write in the 37-page injunction and supporting materials. In an overarching response to the COVID-19 pandemic, defendants have criminalized the operation of so-called non-essential businesses across Oregon. Also named as a defendant was Oregon Public Health Director Lillian Shirley. The plaintiffs include a diverse swath of independent businesses and sole proprietors, a Salem furniture store that had to lay off 11 employees, a hair salon in the Pearl District, a tattoo and body piercing studio in Hood River, a 24-hour gym in Beaverton, a restaurant in Yonkala, and two bars. All of these plaintiffs are on the brink of losing their businesses, the attorneys say. Others include businesses that were indirectly impacted by the governor's orders, a liquor store with locations in Hood River and the Dalles that lost all of their bar and restaurant accounts, and a lingerie store that had to close because it was located inside a mall. The final plaintiff is Open Hour Oregon, a nonprofit representing, quote, multiple businesses seeking to reopen, according to the lawsuit. No Canby businesses are listed as plaintiffs. The attorneys employ colorful language in their efforts to make their constitutional case against the state. For example, as formerly hardworking Oregonians suffer under what amounts to statewide house arrest, unable to do little more than emerge from their homes for a stroll, they cry out for an adult authority who will put an end to the notion that Oregonians may be herded like cattle under the delusion that disease can be eliminated from the herd. And that was just one of several cattle metaphors used by the attorneys. They also cite numerous precedents in other cases that they say lay the groundwork for their claim, and even, quote, from famous philosophers like Albert Camus, author of The Plague. They describe the governor's rules for closing some businesses to prevent the spread of COVID-19 and not others as inherently arbitrary, and say her orders should, quote, shock the conscience. The notion that healthy Oregonians operating businesses with healthy employees should simply cease operations to limit the transition of a disease akin to COVID-19 is shocking and unprecedented in American history, they say. The action was taken without regard to local conditions, without regard to protective measures businesses may implement, and without regard to all of the countervailing harms, including public health harms, that arise from destroying the lives of organ-donating people. The suit does not argue that COVID-19 presents no threat at all, just that it warranted narrower measures aimed at protecting those who are most at risk, including those who are over the age of 60, have underlying health conditions, or live in communal settings like long-term care facilities. Canby attorney Tyler Smith has successfully stayed Governor Brown's orders in the past on the grounds that they harmed small business interest and violated owners' rights, including as recently as 6 months ago when his firm won a permanent stay against the state ban on flavored vaping products. To read the full complaint, visit this story on our website, canbynowpod.com. The governor's office on Tuesday shared new guidance on reopening one aspect of life in Oregon that wasn't technically closed under the first place, and that's local churches. While schools, theaters, museums, arenas, restaurants, bars, barbershops, and many other businesses were specifically called out in the governor's executive orders, churches were not. Most closed anyway out of a concern for the health and safety of their congregants, as well as being unable to meet guidelines on large gatherings. House Republican leader Christine Drazen held a conference call Thursday that included a number of local pastors and faith leaders in her district, including several from Canby. One of the biggest frustrations she's heard has been about the lack of access to information. Many faith leaders have said they would appreciate webinars or other guidelines from the Oregon Health Authority about how to conduct services safely when the time comes.
I think the biggest concern from our pastors and our faith community revolved around clarity. They were all looking for clear definitions and clear guidance. And they wanted to be able to feel confident that when they do reopen their churches, that they are providing an environment that's safe for all of their congregation that's present.
Some of that guidance came Tuesday morning in a webinar hosted by the governor's office and other state officials and joined by more than 1,000 faith leaders across the state. The general information was that churches in those counties approved to enter phase one may begin a limited reopening as early as May 15th, including gatherings of up to 25 people, as long as the 6-foot physical distancing guidelines can be maintained. Home gatherings of 25 or fewer would also be permitted, with the recommendation that the same groups meet each week rather than intermixing. Activities such as baptisms, coming-of-age ceremonies, weddings, funerals, conversion ceremonies, and dedications would be allowed under the same size limits and guidelines. Music, a common aspect of most worship services, was a special concern. According to the governor's deputy health advisor, Jackie Yerby, singing in a choir has been associated with extensive spread of COVID-19, likely because vigorous singing is more likely to result in the expulsion of potentially infectious droplets from the throat. The use of face coverings during worship is recommended, but would likely not be required under the Phase 1 guidelines, officials said. Ron Swor, senior pastor of Canby Foursquare Church, took time recently to address concerns from some members of the faith community, which have become louder in recent days.
People are talking about their religious freedoms being hampered. I want to address that just for one moment. I know for me, and I understand religious freedom, my freedom as a pastor has not been stifled in these last several weeks. I have not been ordered to stop teaching the Bible. I have not been ordered to stop talking about Jesus and his saving grace. I have not been ordered by the governor or law enforcement to keep quiet, sharing what unifies God's people, the church, and that is the gospel of Jesus Christ.
On the contrary, he said, his church and others have experienced exponential growth even during the COVID shutdown. And he pointed out, there are millions of Christians around the world who have no church building to go to because of religious persecution, poverty, or other factors.
And I want to say this to the church community. Please remember that the church has never been defined by the buildings it meets in. I do want to come back to a building. I want to be part, again, of community and seeing you in person. But that has never defined the church over the last 2,000 years. The church is the body of Christ, a living, breathing, life-giving force on this planet.
Swore said he, like many other local faith leaders, does want to reopen their church doors as soon as possible, but he understands that there's a process involved. He said they are planning, preparing, and working towards what he calls a safe and joyous return. It was a sad week for those watching the summer event calendar for Canby. As expected, basically everything has been canceled. The first domino to fall was the Cutsforth Cruise-In, which had been scheduled for August 29th. Cutsforth market owner and longtime organizer of the popular car show, Frank Cutsforth, said the governor's latest guidance, which recommends all large events be canceled or significantly modified through at least September, left him no choice. "I've got no choices, Tyler," Cutsforth said in a phone interview with the Canby Now podcast Tuesday. How do you do it? We can't push it too far into the fall. The guidelines right now are for no more than 25 people. We're way over that. The event is also a major money-making opportunity for local vendors and small businesses, as well as a fundraiser for several nonprofits and community organizations. For many of these businesses and organizations, the loss of the summer's major events, including the Cruise-In, will be devastating. He said he's gotten phone calls from a number of regular attendees from all over the county, including some who have been coming every year since the Cruise-In began. He said they have been disappointed, of course, but they understand the decision. "It is what it is," Cutsforth said. "I feel worse for our restaurants and the folks who are trying to make a living right now. This isn't what I do to make a living. This is just to bring a little Americana to Canby. We will be back." The next Cutsforth Cruise-In has been scheduled for August 28th, 2021. Later that same day, the Hot Rod DreamWorks annual car show and car giveaway was canceled for August 1st. Organizers are still accepting donations for the event's intended charity, which is Relay for Life. Wednesday was even bloodier, as Canby's Independence Day celebration, the Clackamas County Fair, and the Big Night Out Street Dance were all confirmed to be canceled. Fairgrounds director Lori Bothwell announced the fair decision during the Canby Leaders Community Update Wednesday night.
"And I'm here to confirm that the Clackamas County Fair has been canceled for this year. The fair board, my staff, none of us take that lightly. It's like losing our best friend. But we want to have the community be safe. And the social distancing measures of sitting in the rodeo arena, it's just too soon. Hopefully we'll be back bigger and stronger next year."
She said the fairgrounds is working with Clackamas County Junior Livestock Auction to arrange alternatives, perhaps even a virtual auction, that would allow the youth of the county to still showcase their hard work and earn a little money for their troubles. Bothwell asked residents to follow to the fairgrounds Facebook page, where staff will be sharing updates about future activities that would be permitted under the coronavirus guidelines. "Yeah, we are planning some things," she said. "We might not be able to do the fair, but we are working on some things to bring the community together in a safe way." The Clackamas County Fair started in 1907 and has been held at the fairgrounds in Canby for over 110 years. The 2020 fair had been scheduled for August 18th through the 22nd. A developer once again has the lead on turning Canby's former library building into the town's first brewery. Oregon City Brewing Company was selected by Canby City Council Wednesday night as the most promising of four proposals submitted for the nearly 11,000 square foot building on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Holly. The owner and operators of the popular brew pub in downtown Oregon City said in their proposal that they would love to do the same thing in Canby. Their vision for the city-owned property, which has gone through several false starts in its past attempts at redevelopment, is bold and ambitious. They call it the Beer Library. "And I don't know about you, but they've got us at that name. We would love to be able to hang out in a pub and still be able to tell our spouses truthfully that we're just down at the library." The brew pub would feature three permanent indoor food carts offering a diverse array of cuisines, on-site brewing, including the company's burgeoning barrel aging and blending operations, and, I kid you not, an honest-to-goodness arcade, which would be open to all ages until late into the evening. The developers would drastically transform the existing space, including peeling back a portion of the roof to create an outdoor courtyard in the heart of the project. In short, the beer library would be a multi-use, family-friendly brewery that aims to be a living room for the community. It may sound almost too good to be true, and well, there is one teensy little problem. Oregon City Brewing, who would like to purchase the property outright, is offering only a fraction of the property's estimated value. And that fraction is only about 1/100th. You see, the company is offering only $10,000 for the building, which was appraised several years ago at approximately $950,000. This request for a proposal process coincided with one of the worst economic calamities to hit the beverage industry since Prohibition, an almost total shutdown of bars, brew pubs, and tasting rooms caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, which is far from over. Oh, it's amazing how much has changed in the 2 months since I drafted this proposal, said Oregon City Brewing owner Bryce Morrow. We have been forced to temporarily lay off 13 of 15 staff since our forced closure due to COVID-19 on March 17th. We had to pivot our business to selling canned beers, and while we are finding some success, it is far from business as usual. One thing we are certain of is that humanity will continue and people will again gather for food and drink. As to when this will happen, is anyone's best guess. The OC Brewing concept was far and away the favorite of the four concepts presented at last week's City Council work session, but their purchase offer was a non-starter. I think it activates the downtown the way we want, Mayor Brian Hodson said of the beer library. I think it creates a greater draw into downtown. I think being kitty-cornered from the park creates an extension of their patio, which could be a nice space. I don't like the $10,000 purchase price. The first time I read it, I thought it was a typo. Oregon City was not the only lowball. Of the three others, a neighborhood health center, a community marketplace, and Thelma's Place, the offers ran the gamut from $25,000 to $167,000. Councilor Greg Parker said he would be in favor of rejecting them all. Send a clear message, he said. Someday this property is going to be worth more than $10,000. It could be worth more than $1 million. And we will go down in history as the council who sold a $1 million piece of real estate for $10,000. So, my vote, reject them all. The council directed the economic development team to go back tomorrow to discuss his willingness to negotiate on the purchase price or openness to a lease agreement. Just over a year ago, the city had started discussions on a lease agreement with the local owners of the Cambie Brewing Company, but were unable to come to terms. The Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Administration, better known as Oregon OSHA, has again hit a Cambie-based general contractor, Kalima Construction, with significant fines for allegedly failing to follow proper safety guidelines and protect its workers. Oregon OSHA fined Kalima nearly $235,000 for violations of multiple safety rules that state inspectors say they observed at job sites in Bend, Almsville, and Tigard. According to the state, the contractor has a record of overlooking worksite safety requirements, including breaking fall protection rules at least 6 times since 2017. The repeated violations have resulted in steeper fines, Oregon OSHA said. Oregon OSHA Administrator Michael Wood had strong words, saying, "It is inexcusable to ignore practical safety standards that have, time and again, proven effective at protecting workers from on-the-job hazards. Yet this employer continues to disregard the need to effectively address those rules, sidestepping its responsibilities, and putting lives at needless risk." The fines totaling $234,850 stem from 3 citations the division issued against the company in March and April of this year, including having a worker on the roof of a home in Almsville with no fall protection. They follow 2 citations totaling more than $120,000 that Oregon OSHA issued against the company in September 2019. Those citations last year were for the company's failure to meet fall protection requirements at the site of a residential development in Eugene. Falls are the leading cause of death in the construction industry. Kalima has appealed two of the three citations from this year, as well as both of the ones they received last September. And now let's turn our attention to the Canby Police Beat. This is March 17th through the 23rd. March 17th, at 2:30 a.m., following a traffic stop, a driver was cited and released on a misdemeanor probation violation warrant. Then later that day, officers responded to a domestic disturbance. On the 18th at 9:15 p.m., following a report of suspicious circumstance, a vehicle was stopped. The unlicensed driver and passenger did not have permission to use the vehicle, which was later returned to its owner. At 11:36 p.m., a vehicle traveling without its headlights illuminated was stopped. As an officer approached, the vehicle drove away, but it was successfully stopped a short time later. The driver was taken into custody on an outstanding Tillamook County warrant. A firearm, ammunition, knives, and wait for it, methamphetamine were seized from the vehicle. March 19th, report of graffiti painted on the side of a school building on South Redwood. In the afternoon at 2:54 p.m., the report of a hit and run damage to a vehicle. And then at 8 p.m., there was a report of harassment. On the 20th of March, there was a report of an online fraud. Then at 5:30 p.m., report of vandalism to a parked vehicle. 6:25 p.m., an uninsured vehicle was being driven by a suspended driver. It was stopped. The driver was arrested on an outstanding warrant and for possession of cocaine. 8:36 p.m., report of theft at a grocery store. And then later, officers responded to a domestic disturbance. Again on the 21st, another domestic disturbance. And then at 10:15 p.m., a DUII cite and release on Highway 99E. On March 22nd at 3:24 in the a.m., an officer extinguished a fire started by a transient who was burning his clothing. At 1:50 p.m., report of a theft of electronic equipment from a variety store the previous evening. And March 23rd at 3:56 a.m., following a traffic stop, the driver was arrested for DUII, possession of methamphetamine, and unlawful possession of a firearm. And then later that day, there was a response to a person in crisis. Hope they are okay. Then on March 25th, in the evening, a person trespassing on private property was stopped and received a warning. March 26th at 11:50 p.m., there was a report of damage to items in a storage by an unknown suspect. At 7:46 p.m., report of fraud after an unknown person attempted to open unauthorized accounts in the victim's name. And then an uninsured vehicle was stopped and the driver was arrested for possession of heroin and felon in possession of a restricted weapon. The passenger was also arrested for possession of heroin. March 27th, 7:26 in the a.m., a report of a burglary overnight at a closed restaurant. Then at 9:07, officers responded to a report of harassment. And then in the evening at 10:34 p.m., report of a hit-and-run damage to a vehicle whose owner was uncertain of the location where the damage had occurred. March 28th, there was a response to a residence where a person had passed away. 7:49 p.m., report of a theft at a gas station. Then at 11:31 p.m., report of a theft after an unknown person posing as law enforcement contacted a victim by phone and directed them to purchase gift cards. Again, if somebody's asking you to buy them gift cards or pay them in gift cards, it is almost always a fraudulent activity. Don't do it. March 29th, 6 p.m., hit and run damage to a vehicle parked in a grocery store lot. And then at 10:44 p.m., following a traffic stop, a driver was arrested for DUII and for violating a no-contact order on North Maple Street.
Canby, DirectLink is here for you. In these troubling times, the last thing anyone should have to worry about is how to stay connected to their loved ones, work, education, and news. The expert staff at DirectLink are all based right here in Canby and are committed to keeping those critical internet, video, and voice connections on and strong for their members. They have signed the Keep Americans Connected pledge from the FCC, which means they have promised to keep students online to continue their studies, local businesses connected to their customers and employees, and all their members virtually in touch with what matters most to them, no matter how far away they may be. So if you have DirectLink as a provider, go ahead and reach out to your loved ones on a traditional telephone, watch a child's home recital over an internet video chat, download your favorite local podcast, I mean, do we even have to ask what it is, or enjoy a favorite movie at home, because DirectLink will keep our friends, neighbors, and local businesses connected, no matter what. We're all in this together.
Hey friends, you know who the best people in the world are? Of course you do. It's the Cambie Now Patreon Plus members. It's the folks who help support quality, timely, accurate, and incisive journalism for Cambie and the Willamette Valley. I'll tell you what, Tyler Franke and the team here at the Cambie Now podcast love the opportunity to be able to serve you, the listener, with the best news that we can get our hands on. And if you would like to support this work of being a Cambie Now Plus member, please join us by going to cambienowpod.com/plus. This week, we're going to give a special shout out to Heather Z. Heather, thank you for being one of our supporters, helping accelerate the work of local journalism here in the Cambie area. We appreciate you a great deal. If you want to be amazing like Heather, join us as a Cambie Now Plus member. Again, go to our website, cambienowpod.com/plus. On the Cambie Conversation today, we're going to share with you an edited version of a teleconference by Cambie School Board member Sarah Magenheimer that was held this week with local media to discuss the district's $75 million bond package that is on the ballots for the May 19th election. For a more in-depth look at what this bond would cover, find a link to our story in the show notes for this episode.
I'm just kind of wondering, you mentioned obviously how things have changed since the decision was made to put this on the ballot. One of those things being, and you've alluded to it, obviously the financial circumstances for many folks in the Cambie School District being more uncertain now than they were a couple months ago, unfortunately. Another thing, obviously, the move to distance learning, this bond being so focused on school facilities, and right now we are not actually even allowed to use those. So I wonder if you have voters, maybe you've heard from people saying this, do we even really need the schools that much? We're not using them right now, and we're still doing, we're still doing everything that we need. So why put millions and millions of dollars into these facilities that maybe aren't as important as we thought? Would you respond to maybe that question?
Sure. I definitely think we all as a board really empathize with the fact that things look just totally different than they did when we voted to put this on the ballot. And I really think we all recognize that the community has also always been really supportive of our schools, whether that's in the classroom or in our homes, just like we are right now. The bond itself, I think we really focused on, isn't going to raise, as far as the financial part, won't raise taxes, so it won't raise folks' taxes. And I think another important part is, if passed, it comes with that additional $4.6 million in grant funds from the state that Kristen alluded to. And that's really for critical upkeep of our schools, but also there's a large technology component in that bond package that before we knew this was going to happen, we had already identified that we do have an aging technology system within our schools. And that means our internet, our devices for kids at all levels, and also just the technology capacity of our classrooms and teachers. And so that's a big component of the bond. And that was before all of this happened. So I think that will only, as we know more now and how things might need to shift and change as we move forward into the future, it will really help to it will give us an extra ability to strengthen that that partnership with schools and families and kids as we may have to navigate something that looks a little different going down the road. In addition to that, I think we all hope that eventually kids are going to go back into the classroom. So you know, eventually, I mean, as a parent myself, I'm hoping the fact that those schools have, you know, a lot of them are, most of them were built from 1929 to 1976, excluding a couple. And so there's just some real upgrading that needs to happen in order to you know, keep kids safe, comfortable, you know, and teachers in order to have a good learning environment. I think the district has done a really good job of trying to keep these schools in the best condition possible with the funding that they've had. And I think the bond committee also felt like they were all pretty good. And then it was interesting, we did a tour of the schools. And when you walk through the schools, they are, I mean, super clean, very well kept. But really, when you look at just a lot of the infrastructure, whether it's restrooms or classrooms or windows, I mean, there's a lot of really outdated schools and areas that need to be upgraded.
Sarah, the package that was initially approved, do you think that all those needs and priorities are still the same? I mean, you've mentioned that obviously we don't know exactly what, but we know school will look different in this next school year. Hopefully than it does right now. Hopefully we're not still distance learning, but certainly different than before COVID as well. Do you think that the needs that were laid out are all still as high need? Is there the ability to change as maybe some priorities have changed, either within the bond, maybe putting even more toward technology and maybe a little less toward the infrastructure, or is it all pretty set in stone?
That's a really good question. I really think based on what I saw when we went through all of the needs that the district had, when you look at kind of what we were calling that warm, safe, and dry, which was really things, I don't think those are going to change just because they were electrical, heating, air conditioning, air quality, some of those things that I don't think any of us would say we don't want to do those things. And that's a large part of what they were. The other one was safety. And I think, although a lot of change, I think that our community really had a high, and I think all of us, a high interest in improving the safety of our schools. And I don't think that's going to go away either. So that looks like, you know, secure entry vestibules, better entry systems with locking doors using key cards, better intercom systems so that principals and others have the ability to more easily talk to the school as a whole in an emergency situation. So a lot of those safety measures, I think people will still want those to move forward. We'll want to move forward with those. And then, you know, roofing, a lot of the other things I think are going to stay the same. I do think that technology package, which was a big part of the funding of the bond, I think that will look different just because we know more and we'll be able to do better and navigate that to a much higher level than we would have as a district before. We're all very aware of the gaps now where we may not have been as aware of those before. So I think this has just given us more information to do a better job at how we spend that money that's already been allocated. Really, the biggest things and the needs that I see that the bond package will address are around those safety and infrastructure updates. I think we saw a lot of feedback from community members that revolved around those two things. And for me, that looks like the improved heating cooling systems. We had a lot of parents and teachers talking about their classrooms were always cold or they're always hot, or they don't have air conditioning at all for when it gets really hot. Another one that we heard a lot about that I think people will be really interested in improving is the parent pickup drop-off areas, which a lot of the schools, there's just so many cars going in and out and kids. It's really just not as safe as we would like it to be. And there's part of the bond package is allocated to try and redo those areas to improve safety. The other thing is that we looked at that I think is I'm excited about is improving the technology, STEM and vocational learning programs. And I know now that looks like a little different just because we're in a different place, but I was really excited about that part of it. I think that there's a lot of opportunity for us to grow in that area. We've already do a lot at the high school with vocational and kind of CTE programs, but there was monies to help expand that program into the middle and elementary schools, which I felt like was going to really enhance the learning experience of our kids. And I was really excited about that part of it. So that was a small piece, but I felt like a really important and exciting piece to the bond.
Sarah, what do you think will happen if it doesn't pass?
A good question. I think, you know, we definitely didn't approach the marketing of the bond, I guess, like we would have in normal times, just because we're in a different place. And we recognize that. I do think that we also recognize that because this isn't just a adding on to something kind of a bond, that it we're going to have to figure out how to put this forward in another way, thinking about it differently. But the needs aren't the bulk of the bond really was for providing both those infrastructure and safety upgrades, as well as the technology needs, which I think now more than ever, people understand why both that technology piece is important as well. So I don't think we can't let it go away. What we look at next is, I think has a lot to do with kind of where we are as a community and an economy and as a world, even just to how we move forward in the best way possible. It's, I think, interesting. And the other important thing that will be, I know it's a difficult time, but that $4.6 million in grant funds that we will receive from the state was really a lottery. And I think based on our what we've heard, that the chances of us getting that again are kind of slim to none. So we would lose that additional funding, which is, that's a lot for additional work within our district. But all that said, I think we would, as a board, feel like, you know, the health and the safety and the infrastructure and the technology needs of our kids are still going to be there. So we still need to work at figuring out how we can address those moving forward. I think we're really focused on, you know, doing what we can do now for this cycle and just seeing how this works out. Because I think a lot of it will depend on, we've always felt like, you know, hearing from the community is really important. So I don't think that we'll do anything if it doesn't pass. I think we'll have to spend some time checking in with the community, with, you know, that bond committee or additional community group forums to just kind of see where people are at and how we can move forward in the best way possible. And so I don't think it'll go without getting some input from the schools, the teachers, the community as to how we best move forward if it doesn't pass.
And if I'm remembering right, Sarah, part of the initial discussion for even placing it on the ballot for May, you guys looked at November as well. And that was a lot of the data from your consultants and everything indicated that you know, would be a decent place as well. You kind of went with May for the reason of having the additional funding that could come with that. But
yes,
you didn't necessarily have any fears about November. Well, there had been some discussions about that.
Yeah, absolutely. That is all accurate.
Sarah, obviously, and you hear this come through even in the virtual school board meetings that we're doing now. But obviously hear from the teachers and the administrators, their updates and things have been so crazy in the, ever since the COVID crisis started with schools, and you guys have been implementing a whole new system of teaching and learning. I just wonder if you have had a chance to sort of reflect, at this point on all this craziness and, kind of the importance of schools still, the mm-hmm. importance of education. If anything about the situation has kind of brought into greater focus, why, you know, how much what the Canby School District does still matters, or it matters even more.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that our perspectives have all shifted a little based on where we're at now versus where we were a couple months ago. And I think what what I see that is really critical is how integrated the schools are into families whether that's for food, and we've seen that as a major role as providing food for our kids. And I think our district has done a really good job of continuing that service through a really innovative and strong system. But also just the mental health of our kids, like having that connection with their peers and that connection with their teachers, their school community. I think that that has, I think people really have really resonated that that's a huge part of all of our lives, that school community piece. And I think that for me, this bond, it makes that kind of even more important. Like, we really understand that the community that our kids are in is that the school is kind of the center and integral part of that, whether it's how they see their friends, how they learn, how they get their food, how they have activities after and before and after school. And that having that learning environment be have the capabilities to provide that learning with technology, with a safe and warm and dry and healthy, cohesive school building is really critical to making their experience matter, and that experience be something that's high quality, that's helping them be successful as they kind of grow up and move on into the real world.
I meant to ask this earlier, Sarah, when we were talking about how much the bond package could sort of change, but this is in regard to, and these guidelines haven't come yet, but this, some of the sort of physical changes that might need to be made to classrooms for the new COVID guidelines next year, whether that's putting, you know, barriers around desks or things like that. Could any of the bond funding go towards something like that, or would that have to come from existing sources that the district has, or new sources maybe from the state if they're mandating these things?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, there's definitely once the things that are paid for out of the bond really have to fall within what we outlined in our bond package language. And there's an oversight group that will look at that and help manage that. But that being said, I do think that, you know, we have all learned a lot as we've gone through the last couple months about technology, health and safety, whether that's hand washing, hand sanitizer, distance, all of those things. And I certainly think that that at where it fits within the things we were already doing, those things will absolutely be taken into consideration where it can be and will be. I think that both the board and the district, as well as the committee that would be put together to oversee that, would all have that as part of their considerations as we move forward, and where appropriate, things would be managed accordingly in order to address those things where we could. There's definitely really clear rules on how you spend money from when a bond is passed. And you can't spend things on items that were not outlined within the bond package. What I would say is that as we implement things, I think that we'll have a different lens. And so it wouldn't be that we wouldn't spend, like technology is probably a really good example. We would still be doing those things with technology in regards to our internet capacities and our and devices. But I think we would be looking at it differently. Whereas before, we may not have looked at K through three having a one-to-one device as the highest priority. Now it might be a higher priority because we know that we want to plan for everyone to be able to take something home. So I think it would just be a different lens as how we make those decisions. But the funding itself would stay within the same buckets, I guess. But how those buckets are kind of focused and what that looks like when it actually gets into the school might be adjusted accordingly so that we are identifying you know, as another example might be the entry vestibule as we talk about security. But what does that also look like for, you know, trying to help people maintain social distance? So I think it's just a matter of just a different factor that I think will be evaluated as we implement the things we've outlined within the bond. I think the most important, I feel like I kind of said this a little bit before, but just to really... Overall, I think we all really recognize we're in a different time than we were when we first voted to put this on the bond. But I also know that our community has always been really engaged in our schools, in whether it's sports or education or extracurricular activities or community activities. And I know that, you know, the safety and the quality of learning is really important to our community. I think it's really critical to know that the bond doesn't raise taxes, and if passed, comes with that additional $4.6 million in grant funds from the state. And it's really critical to upkeep the aging infrastructure of our schools as we move forward. I also think that another really important part is that the bond technology improvements really do support and strengthen our ability to have a robust, interactive online learning experience, which is really even more relevant and important as we move forward today. So I think those are a couple things that I feel like just are really the high points of where we're at.
Thank you. Well, Sarah, I just want to say thank you so much for taking time out to do this. I can't imagine that it was easy to say, yes, I'll defend this bond that was put in play, or this measure that was put together before the world changed. I really appreciate it. I think it does show that you and the district and school board's commitment to this kind of education piece, and just the need really does exist. And even though the circumstances for many have changed, the reasons for putting it before voters are still sound. So we appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Joining us once again on the Can Be Now podcast is Derek Hill of Advantage Mortgage. He joins us on the line, of course. How are things in the industry right now with all the crazy stuff going on?
It's a little crazy, but not too crazy. I mean, we definitely have seen some things tighten up. Obviously, with any kind of uncertainty, banks tend to tighten their guidelines. So the great thing about being a broker is that even though some of our lenders are tightening up, we have others that aren't. We have a lot of lenders that are just status quo. They're like, hey, we still have all the same channels. We still have all the same credit score requirements. Interest rates may be a little bit higher because of the level of risk, but they're still funding loans. So actually March was one of the biggest months of our company's funding. So we're still funding loans. There's still people out there buying. There's still people out there selling. We have to make sure that we're not, spreading the virus and whatnot, but everything's still moving along.
Well, so how can people get in touch with you right now?
The easiest way is just call the office, 503-266-5800, or send us an email, derek@findtheadvantage.com, but just call the office and we'd be happy to help.
Awesome. Thanks, Derek. Hang in there.
All right. You as well. Derek Hill, NMLS 50183, Equal Housing Opportunity.
All right, friends. Hey, it's James again, wrapping up this episode, as always, with Can Be Then, which is brought to you by The Book Nook, Canby's amazing local bookstore and gift shop. It's your source for new and used books, comic books, audiobooks, vintage books, and, well, you get the idea. All things books across from the backstop in downtown Canby. You walk to the kitchen sink, you turn on the faucet, and there's water. You flip the light switch, and there's power. You hop online to check out the latest news on the website of the Can Be Now podcast, and it's there. You don't think about all these little miracles, which happens hundreds of thousands of times a day in our little town. We just take them all for granted. But the truth is that the history of electricity, running water, telephone service, and other utilities in our area is a fascinating one, and it's a subject we'll be exploring on this next series on Can Be Then. Electricity came to our fair city in 1902. Prior to that, Canby's carefully platted blocks had been lit by street lamps with coal oil. Aurora Electric was the original supplier of electric service to Canby. William S. Hurst, a Aurora warehouse owner, built a flume from a pond just north of the railroad tracks, which he used to power a plant that provided electricity to Canby, Aurora, and eventually Barlow. A steam plant later replaced it after it was destroyed in a fire. A few years later, a group tried to form Canby's first power plant under the newly formed Canby Canal Company. The group included Mr. Canby himself, M.J. Lee, the dynamic grandson of pioneer Philander Lee, who had donated a portion of his land to form the town's first 24 blocks. M.J. Lee and company dug a canal to carry Mallala River water from a point below Goods Bridge to a power plant the company was building on the site of a former sawmill that now lies within the boundaries of Canby Community Park. The plant had a huge water wheel that was meant to generate electricity, but the flow from the new canal proved too weak, and output was minimal. Aurora Electric continued to be the chief supplier for the growing town. Though the Canby Canal Company failed, its 30-inch concrete walls would stand for 70 years as a monument to the enterprising Lee and his colleagues, even resisting an attempt to demolish it by 200 sticks of dynamite in 1959 after the city council had declared it an attractive nuisance. Demand for electricity eventually exceeded the capacity of Hearst's Aurora plant, and Aurora Electric began to buy power from the Portland Electric Power Company, which generated power at its plant at Willamette Falls in Oregon City. Before World War I, E.G. Robinson purchased Aurora Electric, renamed it Mallala Electric, and had its offices for a time in Canby. By January 1923, Mallala Electric was serving the cities of Canby, Aurora, Barlow, Hubbard, Donald, Fargo, Butteville, and Wilsonville. As demand grew, so did the cost of providing power, and not surprisingly, those costs were ultimately passed on to customers. In August 1921, Canby's Clackamas County News told of a meeting at an old band hall in which angry residents voted to remove electric lights from homes rather than pay prices they declared unjust. They had a point. Rates in Canby had nearly tripled, from $3.45 per 20 kilowatt hours, while many valley towns were paying $1.49 for the same amounts. "We do not want special rates," M.J. Lee, chairman of the meeting, said at one point, "but we do want $1.49 worth of electricity for $1.49. A defective interurban wiring system, which causes loss of power, was given by Frank Zollner as the probable cause of the rise in rates, but the people of Canby didn't see why they should have to pay for a mistake made by the electric company. The city council also voted to cut back on their street lights at the time, reducing the number of lighted lamps from 60 to 9. Only those on Northwest First Avenue remained lit. Much of the city lived in darkness for several months until the council passed a measure authorizing the city to build or buy their own municipal light and power system, which would be paid for by a bond that the citizens of Canby approved the following year. In August 1922, the council voted 5-1 to purchase Mallala Electric and its entire distribution system for the grand sum of $7,787. The purchase included the street lighting system, valued at $600. It wasn't until March 27, 1923 that the bill of sale was in the city's hands. In 4 years, the bond issue had been paid off. About that time, Portland Electric Power, which is known today as Portland General Electric, or PGE, offered the city $47,800 to buy the system. It went to a vote to the people in November of 1927 and lost by a single vote. A similar proposal was offered in 1928, and after a hard-fought bidder campaign, the election drew 377 people, but the measure lost again. Despite other takeover offers from the other major power companies, the city has retained control of its electrical system since the 20s. In the late 1930s, the city began to explore the possibility of buying electricity from the Federal Bonneville Power Administration, an effort that was led by Mayor J.R. Vineyard. On December 22, 1939, Canby became one of the first cities to sign with the BPA. The 20-year contract was to buy electrical energy at wholesale, with minimum purchase of 3,000 kilowatt-hours per year, and sell to its customers at retail. The agreement proved profitable for the city of Canby, and in 1941, the Canby Light Department reported it had earned a net profit of $7,649.24 during the first 12 months under the BPA agreement. Canby's primary power facility at that time was at Southwest 4th and Birch. Two new substations were built in the 1950s, one at the northeast corner of Knights Bridge and Barlow Road, and one off of North Redwood Street near Highway 99E. Both remain in use today. The Canby Utility Board, also known as CUB, was created by an amendment to the city charter in 1970. CUB was given the authority to operate and manage all facilities, services, and aspects of the city's electrical system, as well as the municipal water department. CUB issued its first utility bills for electricity, water, and sewer services to residents of Cambie in August of 1972. Cambie was served primarily by BPA from early 1940s until August of 1995. Because of deregulation of the power industry and to acquire competitive prices for the citizens of Cambie, CUB had issued a request for proposal for a new contract in January 1995, and they eventually signed with PGE to provide power for almost all of the city's needs. Just to leave the door open, the city continued to purchase a single kilowatt of power each year from the BPA. That proved to be a wise decision in 2001, when rates changed once again, and the Cambie utility returned to being a full customer of the BPA, which remains the case today. And up next, it is everyone's favorite subject, Cambie's drinking water. It's the history of Cambie Water System next time on Cambie Then. Until then, thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by the Wild Hair Saloon in Cambie in Oregon City. The coronavirus has changed much about how the Wild Hair does business, but it has not changed the where, the why, or who they do it for. Owners Joan and Darren Monin, both lifelong Cambie residents, are as committed to the community they love as they've ever been. Even as the service industry has been deeply impacted by the current public health situation, they continue to rally behind Cambie, its people, and especially those most in need. We are so grateful for their continued support in this difficult time. As we've always said, the Wild Hair is a place where Cambie goes to eat and have fun. That hasn't really changed. You just have to take your food and, you know, go eat it somewhere else. Until the governor's stay-home orders expire, the Wild Hair's friendly staff will be there to handle your carryout orders Monday through Friday from 11:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. They continue to offer their full menu of delicious food options, and they're doing a weekly meal deal that serves a family of four for only $25. Find the latest on their Facebook page, full menu available online at thewildhairsaloon.net. Give them a holler today at 503-651-4273.
The Cambie Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden, so round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Cambie by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Cambie Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Cambie Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Cambie's locally owned full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.